Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. And I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. And it's my great pleasure to introduce to you today Gabriel Thompson, the author of Fred Ross, America's Social Arsonist, a very interesting book about a man who is not totally forgotten, but does not have the name recognition that a lot of other people have. But he was an early labor organizer. He was the mentor of Cesar Chavez and others and had a major influence on eventually what happened. But he liked to stay behind the scenes, and Gabriel's here to bring him out in front for us. Gabriel.
Thank you for that, and thank you for having me. What I thought I'd do is start a little bit about how I came across Fred Ross, because, as you said, he's not in certain small circles, he's legendary, and in much bigger circles, he's mostly unknown. For me, the journey to writing this book started in the fall of 2007. I was in Tucson, Arizona, and I was getting ready to work on a previous book about immigrant labor. And that book essentially involved me spending a year doing jobs often done by undocumented Latino immigrants. And I was getting ready to go to Yuma, Arizona to cut lettuce for a company called Dole. And I grew up in California, so I knew farm workers as the people I drove by at a distance when I'm driving through the Salinas Valley. And that was about it. And I knew it was very hard work. And so in preparation for gearing up for this project, I did some stupid things. For one thing, I thought I should get in good shape, so I started doing push-ups, which is not, served no purpose. I learned very quickly. But I also went to a bookstore and got a couple books about farm worker history. One was The Grapes of Wrath, which I certainly had been assigned, I'm sure. I grew up in California. I'd been assigned in high school, and I am also quite certain that I had never read the book. It looked really big, and then the second book was this book called Sal Si Puedes, which was a book published by recently deceased New Yorker staff writer Peter Matheson, published in the 1960s, kind of an extended profile of Cesar Chavez and the UFW, right at the point at which very exciting things are going on. But they haven't won what becomes like this five-year momentous grape boycott. So I start with The Grapes of Wrath. And in The Grapes of Wrath, if you recall, the Joads leave from Oklahoma, and they have this vision of California where, they will have their own little plot of land, and they'll kind of eke out a very nice rural existence growing their own food. And they realize quite quickly that in California, agriculture is not organized that way. You have a few big owners, and you have a mass horde of migrant armies that go shuffle from place to place, in demand when there's crops to be harvested. And once the crops are harvested, they need to leave as quickly as possible. And if they don't leave quickly enough, their little shanty towns will be burnt to the ground and they'll be arrested. In that book, Grapes of Wrath, what struck me is that the Joads set out and they suffer one calamity after another. But there's one point in which their luck sort of turns, and that's when they arrive in the San Joaquin Valley, and they show up late at night. They've been burnt out of a squatter's camp to a government camp run by the federal government for migrant farm workers themselves. And what they discover there is that that camp is run by the Okies and Arkies. They make the decisions. There's an elected council. They've decided not to let cops inside the camp without a warrant. Cops at that time were more likely than not to smash their heads open with billy clubs if they refused to leave. And it was this example of a place where they sort of had this safe space to sort of stabilize and move sort of back into the stream of mainstream society a bit, at a time when the rest of the state out there was incredibly hostile to them. So that camp, to me, coming out of an organizing background, was really interesting. Steinbeck called that camp Weed Patch. So I put that book down and I read Sal Si Puedes. And in Sal Si Puedes, what jumped out at me right away was when Peter Matheson asked Cesar to describe how he got involved in organizing. And Caesar takes him back to 1952 in East San Jose in a neighborhood called Sal Cipuedes, where he was living. And in Spanish, Sal Cipuedes means get out if you can, which gives you a sense of what it was like. Streets weren't paved. There were no sewer. There was no sewer system. There were all sorts of health disparities. And the white power structure of San Jose really did not care at all. It was sort of what, in a decade's time, Michael Harrington would call the other America, invisible. But one day, this white guy starts showing around, showing up in Sal Cipuedes, knocking on doors, talking to people. And as Caesar describes this story, this white guy, who turns out to be Fred Ross, won't stop coming to his little house, wanting to talk about who knows what kind of project. Caesar is immediately convinced that Ross is trying to sell something to them. And so he does not want to be around. And so he, at first, he's not around the first time Ross shows up. Caesar's wife, Helen, says, he says he's going to be come back at 7 tonight. Caesar says, well, that's great. That's exactly when I'm going to be over at my brother's house, so I don't have to deal with this guy. This happens for a few days until finally Helen, as Caesar tells this story to Matheson, says, I'm not lying to this guy anymore. You are a big enough man that if you're not interested in talking to him, you stay in the house and you tell him no thanks. So Caesar obeys Helen. Ross shows up. Ross goes into some sort of pitch about wanting to have a meeting in Caesar's house. And Caesar surprisingly says, fine, I'll bring a bunch of people. Which I imagine Ross hearing that and thinking, breakthrough. What Ross didn't know is that Caesar has a plan to sort of ambush Ross. He invites a bunch of his friends on the night of the meeting. As Caesar tells the story, not that many of them were sober. Many of them had run-ins with the law. And that Caesar's real plan at that meeting was that to teach Ross that he was not only not welcome in his living room, but he certainly wasn't welcome poking his nose around in East San Jose, doing whatever sort of project he had that probably what was meant to benefit him. And so he came up with this plan, and the plan was that they would let Ross get into his little spiel in the living room. Caesar would have a cigarette in his left hand. When Caesar switches his cigarette to his right hand, that's the sign that they start giving Ross a hard time. And they start basically chasing him out of that living room and out of that neighborhood. Ross shows up, and I think he was quite excited because there are tons of people in this living room. You know, this is a breakthrough. And he starts talking to Chavez about the work that he had been doing. Ross had recently moved up from East L.A. In East L.A., in 5 years, he had helped create a group called the Community Service Organization, a very bland, very boring, very uncontroversial name for a group that really had a radical purpose, which was to build the power of Mexican Americans across the, first in L.A. and then across the state. And he talked about the work they had done. They had elected the first Spanish-speaking council member to East L.A. in 70 years. They had cracked down on police brutality. A lot of, when you look at Ross, a lot of the issues, these are contemporary. These are 60, 70 years ago. These are also today. They had successfully helped prosecute the first case in LAPD's history in which cops were found guilty for using excessive force, especially against Latinos, and actually served jail time. Caesar's listening to this, and the cigarette is remaining in the left hand. It never shifts over. And at a certain point, some of his buddies get upset because they're ready to kind of like chase this guy out, and maybe they're too inebriated to even be listening. And they start interrupting, and Caesar quickly escorts them out of the apartment, of the house, comes back, and wants to hear more about Ross. And at the end of that meeting, asks what I can do to build what you built in L.A. in San Jose. So I put down that book at that point. That's like page 30 or 40. And I immediately thought, who the hell is Ross here? What is going on? This is the McCarthy era. This is a white guy wandering around East San Jose talking about political power, organizing Mexican-Americans. I subsequently learned he doesn't even speak good Spanish. He looks like a Hollywood star. He looks like he's lost. And yet he has this plan. When I put that book down and I did a little bit of quick research about Ross, I was very intrigued not only to learn that he had born in 1910, dies in 1992, spends most of his life organizing, but that one of the first jobs he has after college is managing this migrant camp in the San Joaquin Valley called Arvin. And that Arvin was the same camp that Steinbeck visited many times doing research for the Grapes of Wrath. And he fictionalized that camp as Weed Patch. And so for me, it was like, this is a guy who connects Steinbeck and the Grapes of Wrath and the Depression to Cesar Chavez and the farm worker rebellions of the 60s and 70s. And I think from there, I especially once I learned that the book had not been written, which is like gold for anyone who's looking for a good topic, I decided that I think I wanted to try to write that book. In thinking about Ross, who like I said, led such a long life, as a biographer, and this is the first time I've written a biography or history book, the key question is, who is Ross? And there's different ways of answering that, but I think one way to look at it is that Ross, besides being this lifelong organizer, was really, really, really wanted to be a writer. He spent his life writing and trying to get published, to the extent that in 1968 I came across this letter in which he mentions that the book he's working on right now has 1,500 pages. He works on that book until the 80s. I think at some sense he thought that that many pages was sort of a promising, like, yes, I'm really doing it. Most publishers, when you see someone who's got a 2,500-page manuscript, you think, oh boy, there's a real big problem here, like something's not. But he kept adding on and on and on. But what he did, that autobiography was never published, but what he did sort of publish was this little handbook called Axioms for Organizers. And it's sort of these little pithy quotes, kind of a distillation of what he had learned over his many decades in the field. And I just want to read a couple of them because I think it gets a little to the heart of who Ross was. First one, fast talkers. Look out for the fast talkers. The incidentals make up the fundamentals. Shortcuts usually end in detours, which lead to dead ends. In any kind of work, you do a half-assed job, at least you get something done. In organizing, you don't get anything done. There is no substitute for willpower in an organizer. Concentration. When you're pushing a big drive or issue, you stay on it until the total exclusion of everything else until it is done. You're getting a sense here of how Ross operated. I mean, he was meticulous, he pushed. There was nothing more important to him in his life than organizing. Not family, not raising kids, really. I mean, those things had a role in his life, but he was very upfront that what he was put on this world to do was to organize, and that a key part of being an organizer was shoving every other potential distraction aside. Which leads to some painful experiences in his life, you can imagine. I mean, he's twice divorced. He spends his later years living in a primitive one-room cabin, sleeping on a mattress on the floor, eking out an existence sort of with Social Security, but also not at all feeling sorry for himself because he felt like that was exactly, he had done everything he wanted to do in life. A few other ones. When you attempted to make a statement, ask a question. He listened very well. In his archives, there are 444 audio tapes of Ross giving trainings at Stanford, where his papers are. I listened to a small sample of those. He goes over the same stuff over and over and over with new people who are asking the same questions. And at each one of those meetings, his attention is listening so clearly. He loved the craft of organizing in a way that it's hard to imagine anyone else. I got bored listening to a small sampling of it. And I like organizing, and I worked as an organizer, but he took this as sort of like the most important craft. And I think another one is, the duty of an organizer is to provide people with the opportunity to work for what they believe in. And so when he comes across Cesar Chavez, a few years later he comes across Dolores Huerta, who's planning on being a teacher, no plan on being an activist. She walks into that house meeting with Ross. He sweeps her off her feet, sort of in a way, in the descriptions of what they're trying to do. And I think we all pretty much know that Dolores Huerta has never really wavered from both being an organizer and activist. So he had a way of sort of despite being such an outsider. And if you look at this photo, you know, I mean, this is Ross here. He's like this Hollywood-looking white guy who speaks no Spanish, and yet somehow with his attention to listening to people, I think really mentored and inspired a lot of folks. And then the final one is a good organizer, a social arsonist who goes around setting people on fire, which is sort of the basis of the title for this book. He was an unlikely radical, probably you know, one of the most unlikely radicals in terms of you would never guess where he came from to be what he would do. He grew up in an all-white neighborhood of Echo Park in L.A. His parents both referred to poor people as trash. One year, the school boundaries of his district changed, and his mother realized, Daisy, that he was going to be going to a school that had a couple black students in it. So on that first day of school, she marches him down to the principal's office and says, there is no way my son is going to be with black students. He doesn't like them. He's never met one. And we've raised him to stay with his own kind, and that's the way it's going to be. And as a parent, I have a much deeper appreciation of how little we can actually predict about our kids, how wrong we often are. But Daisy was spectacularly wrong. That was Ross spent his whole life sort of working with African-Americans, Mexican-Americans, Native Americans, dirt poor Okies and Arkies. I think his turn towards the left came in the Depression. He, and also at a very unusual place. He went to the University of Southern California, which is not exactly a haven of radicalism, especially not in the 30s. But he met someone, and it's interesting to talk about Adam Hochschild's book. He met a Jewish student named Eugene Wolman, who was brash, arrogant, dedicated, a fighter, a communist, and who opened Ross's eyes to sort of the exciting left-wing politics of the period. Previously, I've got a photo in this book of Ross before he gets to USC, and he's this muscle-bound guy who spends most of his day working out on the beach in Santa Monica. He just looks like a beefhead. You know, he looks like this. You don't see any seeds of a radical in that. But I think Eugene Wolman had a huge influence on introducing Ross to all the swirling, exciting left-wing activities. But even more, he had an influence because Eugene Wolman, when he graduates, goes to fight in Spain with Abraham Lincoln Brigade, and he's killed almost immediately. And for Ross, that leaves a very deep impression. In his archives, there's a document I found in which Ross, probably in his 70s, because the handwriting is quite shaky, has a list of his influences in his life, and right at the top is Eugene Wolman, because Eugene Wolman for him was sort of the ultimate, someone who made the ultimate sacrifice and sort of served as a moral lodestar of the heroic tradition, I think, that Ross wanted to follow. And even in the 80s, he gives an interview in which he says he still feels guilty for not having gone to Spain. So that's an influence on him. When he graduates from USC, he theoretically wants to be a teacher. There's no teaching jobs. So he gets a job working with the government, handing out relief checks to dirt poor farm workers. And then he goes to Arvin, this migrant camp, in which he's living with all of these folks that have come from Oklahoma, Arkansas. And it's his first experience of not just thinking of poor people as people who have been crushed down abstractly, but really being with them day after day after day. And there are plenty of people, I think, who like the idea of organizing poor people or who have a political philosophy about that poor people are crushed. But when they get in the messiness that is with working with real people with real issues, they become disillusioned because they don't... they are just as convoluted and sort of messed up as we all are. But Ross loved that. He was so curious about the work. And so he would go from tent to tent. This was his strategy to win people over. The previous camp manager actually had been kicked out by the migrants because he had done things like whacked children with handsaws. He was a very nasty man. So Ross felt like he had to win these folks over, and so his plan for winning folks over was going from tent to tent and saying outside, wow, it sounds like there's some really good coffee brewing. Could I come in and have some coffee with you? And sit down with them and have coffee, and then go to the next tent. And he wrote that it was an incredible way to get to know people, while it was also incredibly painful because there were dozens and dozens of tents, and by five or six tents into it, he really had to go to the bathroom, but he had to get these four or five more tents done. And the other thing that was interesting is that The Grapes of Wrath comes out in April of 1939. Ross arrives at that camp in June of 1939. And that fall, the workers go out on strike. It's a huge cotton strike. Ross has a front row seat. He's been told by his manager. There's a lot of skepticism that these new camps providing shelter for Okies are going to be kind of subversive bases. And they were. There were places where that were organizing bases. And Ross was told, you cannot have any sort of, you can't be partisan, you can't support their efforts at all. His sort of take on that was, he wrote column after column imploring people to go out on strike. He actually played an active role. Woody Guthrie started showing up from L.A., singing songs to the strike workers, bedded down for the night on the grass out front of Ross's manager's quarters. Two union organizers showed up, and Ross would go tent to tent and listen to them. And it was a real wake-up call for Ross when he realized that there were two union organizers attempting to pull off a statewide strike of cotton workers. So he'd be in these tents, and the workers would be like, yes, we're with you, we want to do this union thing, so we've got these folks, who do you guys have? And the one union worker would say, well, there's me, and there's this guy. And they'd be like, well, who else do you have on your team to organize in California? And he's like, well, it's both of us, you know, as if that was. And so I think Ross was extremely moved by their audacity and found it inspiring. But it was also cautionary because the strike got crushed. It got crushed incredibly violently. Farmers' groups waded into rallies with chains and pickaxes and just smashed people. And the folks that got smashed were the folks that ended up in jail. And so I think he took from that both the fact that it's incredibly exciting to encourage people to take action, but it's a serious game you're playing, you know, that the repercussions can be major, and that you want to do whatever possible. If they are going out of their way to take these huge risks that could put their family at risk or they could be evicted, you as an organizer really have to take that seriously and do everything you can. After Arvin, he spends, World War II starts, and he spends those couple years working to try to secure the release of Japanese Americans in internment camps. And I think that, for me, that was a really, there are periods of Ross that some people knew, Cesar Chavez, UFW, but there was a lot of periods Ross did not talk about his personal life when he was organizing. And so one of the great things for me, a great privilege for me, was to go back into the archives and find the reports that, like at Bancroft and UC Berkeley, that talked about the work he was doing with Japanese Americans. And it was in some ways an impossible assignment, because just recently, Japanese Americans had been considered, and by FBR, FDR had instituted this, were so dangerous that they had to be kind of put away in these barbed wire camps. Ross's job at that time was to convince landlords and employers in Cleveland and inland areas that those same people that were an existential threat to us now should be hired, now should be living in their apartments. And he did that for a couple of years. And then he came back to San Francisco, and once the Pacific had reopened to Japanese Americans, his role was almost more difficult, which was to convince everyone in San Francisco that it was okay for Japanese Americans to come back. And so I think he wasn't exactly organizing, but that period really gave him a sense of how you move people, how you convince people, how you sometimes do it through soft negotiations, and sometimes you say, that's the way it's going to be. You can bend them, but sometimes you can break them a little bit. And I think that was important for him. Then became his real, I think, lasting legacy, which was he became convinced through a number of folks in the 1940s when he starts organizing that Mexican Americans, California, it's hard to remember what it was like for folks, especially in some of the Inland Empire areas of LA, for Mexican Americans or for Mexicans. Not that anyone made much of a difference who were hostile towards them, but you know, they couldn't be buried in certain cemeteries. They had to sit up in the balcony in movie theaters, or they had to sit right with their noses pressed against the screens. White trade signs were all over the place. And so Ross really cut his teeth, I think, organizing around those issues. And he was able to help groups toss out racist city council people. He was able to help lead to the first federal desegregation case in the country, 5 years before Brown versus Board of Education. But it had to do with Mexican-American students. It's gotten much much less play, but I think it's Thurgood Marshall, for example, was one of the people that signed an amicus brief in support of this. So he was very aware of sort of the nature of this. And then he spends the 40s, 50s, and some of the 60s building this group called the CSO that revolutionizes sort of the Mexican-American power, political power in California. And I think you can't understand the UFW without understanding the CSO. The CSO is where Cesar Chavez spends 10 years working alongside Ross. The CSO is where 3 years later Dolores Huerta meets Ross and becomes active. There are so many people that came out of that formed the nucleus of what became the United Farm Workers. And so I think another reason I was really excited about diving into this project was that history not only hasn't really been told, but that you can't understand. If you think the UFW was launched in 1965 when workers went out on strike in Delano with grapes, then you don't actually understand how it got started. You have to remember that in 1952, Ross knocked on Cesar Chavez's door. You have to remember that in 1955, he recruited Dolores Huerta into a house meeting. You have to remember all this work that went into it. Finally, like, why does Ross still matter? And you know, there's probably two big types of biographies that are written. One is a biography of someone who, you know, like World War II and Nazis, in which there's maybe or books about that where there's maybe 48,000 books about that topic, and so you have to figure out like the one angle or two angles that make it add something to it. And then there is a biography of someone that almost no one knows, and Ross is that sort of person. And so I think when you look at why Ross still matters, a few things. First, the people he trained have gone on to really shape California history. They've shaped U.S. history. They've sort of revolutionized and dramatically trained. The UFW showed a different way of labor organizing, in which it was really a combination of not just narrow labor fights, but about bringing those labor fights to a general public and having a story that resonated. I mean, they still have the most successful, by far, consumer boycott of products in U.S. history. There's never been anything like that in the past. The people he trained, Chavez, Huerta, Marshall Gans, who helped develop Barack Obama's 2008 campaign, and then also the methods he developed. I'll tell you a quick story about this just to give a sense of it, which is I was organizing in Brooklyn on an issue of lead paint poisoning, which clearly now is not an issue that's in our past when you look at what's happening now. And I was working in Bedford-Stuyvesant in Brooklyn, and we did this study in which we tested many dozens of homes for lead dust in Brooklyn, and we found that more than one third had very high levels of lead dust with kids under two, in which they're the most susceptible to sort of major brain damage that's irreversible. The guy that was sort of my supervisor decided that what we should do in this, it wasn't just a research project, it was an organizing project. We wanted to get people moving. And for each family that had lead dust, we asked them to invite their close family and friends, come to a meeting in their living room, in which we could sort of talk about not just how we're going to get your apartment fixed, but the fact that this is a neighborhood-wide problem. It's not a problem that happened on the Upper East Side. At that point, 92% of the lead poisoning kids in New York City were children of color. And we asked them to have these house meetings. So they invited family and friends, and then we would go into our kind of spiel about the campaign, and at the end of each house meeting, we would go around and ask each person that had come, we need you to hold a house meeting. And then they would say, well, I don't know who I can invite. And they say, well, do you have family? Oh, yeah, of course I have family. Well, do you have any close friends that care about what you care about? Of course I have those folks. There are these social networks that we aren't always aware of. We did that over and over and over. And the end result was we had a huge mass of folks that were incredibly pissed off and ready to take action about trying to push a new anti-lead poisoning bill in New York City. And it worked. That year, New York City overrode Mayor Bloomberg's veto. And New York City still has the strongest anti-lead poisoning protection bill in the country. And many other cities sort of use it as a model. When I started working on the Fred Ross book, one of Ross's techniques was this house meeting campaign that he developed organizing with orange pickers in the citrus belt east of L.A. And I thought, that sounds familiar. So I asked my friend Alfredo de Avila, who had been helping oversee our campaign, and he said, yeah, of course. Ross trained me. You were doing Ross techniques. And so I think it speaks a little bit to the breadth and depth of his influence that his DNA is so deeply involved in union groups, in community organizing groups, that sometimes you're operating under a Ross techniques in some ways, and you're completely unaware of it. And I think the final thing, and I'll do a quick reading at the end, but why I was drawn to Ross, and I think he's probably right up there with Saul Alinsky, one of the most influential organizers in American history, and also incredibly unknown, and that's by design. You know, he believed very strongly that an organizer was not supposed to be sort of leading the charge, that was not the appropriate role. But that he reminds us that history is made in quiet places too. You know, he reminds us that history was not just made when Cesar Chavez led a dramatic march in 1965 from Delano to San Francisco, which was, you know, took San Francisco by storm in the financial district. That history was made there, but history doesn't happen without these quiet moments, these quiet behind-the-scene moments that often organizers are a part of. And they're made by people who aren't behind the mic. And so I just wanted to read, if I have time to read, this last section, because I think it gets to a little bit about, again, who Ross was. He was certainly not perfect, you know, and I hope that comes through more in this book. I think he was extremely cavalier about the needs of both of his wives. He was twice divorced, and it's hard and painful to read some of the stories in which he really neglected. His second wife had polio, short story about this, and at one point she's finally coming back from the hospital to their house after a long, painful period, and Ross's one responsibility is to have a hospital bed at that house so that when she arrives, she can be placed on it. And he ends up being at a community meeting at that point. And so there's two different stories that have been told. neither are inspiring. One is that they actually dropped her off on the ground there in the apartment, in the house, which seems less believable to me, but that's what his mother told his daughter. And the other one was that they just took her back to the hospital, of which she'd been there for many months with painful surgeries. And what made that worse, I think, for me, was that not only was that something that you would think you would want to cover up, but when Ross trained organizers, he would use that story as an example of the correct priorities of organizers. And so, you know, I have an incredible amount of admiration, I think, for Ross. And I also have a lot of things that I think were just, in talking to his kids, that were very, very painful. And this little section I want to read towards the end, because I think it gets at a very deep part of what made him tick. It took me 4 years to research and write this book. Along with examining archives in 6 states, I interviewed dozens of people, read wildly in relevant fields, and scoured newspapers and census data for a glimpse of Ross. But biography is a strange and obsessive creature, and I kept coming up with more questions, many of them ultimately unanswerable. Ross was a private person who rarely divulged details of his personal life, and there are gaps that I would like to fill in but can't. Still, one doesn't need to know everything about a person to know something important about that person. While trying to track down countless documents, I was often reminded that it is sometimes the small detail or the story told as an aside that can capture an essential characteristic without which an individual doesn't entirely make sense. So before diving into the narrative, let me share one story about Ross. It is the second week of January in 1945. Ross is driving from Cleveland to California, accompanied by 2 Japanese-American men. The U.S. government had evacuated ethnic Japanese from the West Coast during World War II, and Ross's 2 companions are among the first to legally return. They cross into Southern California on Highway 10 and stop for the night in Indio, a dusty desert city near Palm Springs. When they walk into a crowded restaurant, the room falls silent. After they take their seats, several burly men stand up and walk over, staring with hatred. Another man picks up the phone and calls the police, loudly reporting that, quote-unquote, a couple of Japs have walked through the door and predicting trouble. Ross hurries the men outside. Back at the motel, Ross gathers what he calls his propaganda, pamphlets and flyers that document the bravery of Japanese Americans who have volunteered for the Army. He returns to the restaurant alone, armed with these papers, and proceeds to explain to the men, not all of whom are sober, that the Japanese are now welcome on the West Coast, and that many fought honorably for their country. He stays until the men seem to agree with him, then he picks up 3 meals and returns to the hotel. What struck me about this story? First, of course, was a measure of bravery involved in the act of returning to the restaurant. I would not have done so. Much easier to cut my losses and go somewhere else, especially since no one was there to judge. But more fundamental was what the decision to return revealed about how Ross thought about people. It only made sense to return if you believe that men threatening violence in one moment could be convinced that they were wrong in the next. Ross had that kind of faith. His belief in the decency and potential of ordinary people ran deep, even though, as he had had many chances to witness in his life, and indeed as he had just witnessed, ordinary people often behave badly, but they could be moved and transformed. They could act in ways that would surprise themselves. This conviction inoculated Ross against cynicism and probably goes a long way toward explaining why, unlike his one-time student Chavez, he never gave up on organizing. It didn't matter how bad things had become or how many defeats had been suffered. An organizer could always go looking for the next person, because one never knew what the next person might be capable of. Thank you.
I'd like to remind our audience that they are listening to Gabriel Thompson speaking about his book, Fred Ross, America's Social Arsonist. before we get to the Q&A, one question. Our current president, in this year, we kind of forget that he's still president, but President Obama was a community organizer, right? That, and people have held that against him in some ways. Do you think that that's good preparation for, you know, you've just studied one. Do you think that's good preparation for becoming president?
I just think they're two totally different vocations, you know. And so I think Ross was very skeptical about politicians in general. On the other hand, he spent much of his life running voter registration campaigns. I mean, the work he did in East L.A. To register and to elect Edward Roy Ball, nothing had been done like that anywhere. I mean, in a couple months, they doubled the voter registration rates of Latinos in that city. By the end of that campaign, when he won, the mayor of L.A., who had never stepped foot on the east side, immediately called up Ross and said, hey, I'd love to come over and hear like what kind of issues are I've always been interested in this, but what kind of issues are facing your community. And so I think Ross's passion was in creating blocks of voters who could register, who could vote, but who more than anything didn't find a perfect candidate, but who found candidates, had a way to move whichever candidates were out there. So I think when you become a president or when you become a leader in some sense that's less connected to the base, you have a whole other area, whole other pressures, whole bunch of other people talking to you about what's important. And so to the extent I think that Obama obviously would have a deeper understanding of the fact that if organizers and people in motion are pushing him on something, it creates space for him to do things. On the other hand, if it's something he doesn't want to do, does he appreciate that? I don't think so. You know, and so I think it's not as easy as Obama comes out of. Obama was an organizer. Now he's a president. Now he gets what it is to be an organizer. He knows how important it is. It's more like sometimes you have an agenda, and it might even be that your agenda is to pass some sort of immigration reform, and suddenly all these young dreamers are demanding that you do more. And from a perspective of someone like Obama, it's like you're getting in the way of my you know, you're muddying this up. In fact, that's not what happened. The Dreamers went hard after him for deportation. They went hard after him for Republicans, and they kind of changed the conversation around, and I think made him do something that I don't think he would have done otherwise. And so, I respect, and I've read his writing about organizing is very eloquent and has a deep sense of what it, how things on the ground get changed. But if you're not an organizer anymore, it's less relevant, you know. But it sure provided a lot of, especially with Sarah Palin's idiotic comments, it provided an opening to start talking about organizing as something that is very important and that's not some fringe little thing, but in fact has this deep, deep history, you know?
Great. All right. Who has the first question?
I'm just curious, what did Fred study at USC? What was his main interest then?
Yeah. Well, Gene Wolman, the Jewish student who he worked with, really pushed him to take a class by a professor named Mad Dog Anthony or something. He was the sort of showcase socialist at USC, and he had a course called the Economic Interpretive of History. And I think that played a big role. Ross was also really loved literature and he loved acting, so he did both of those things too. But with a course like that of this professor, they would be discussing issues that Ross had been totally clueless about. For example, this mass in the Depression, this mass movement of shipping Mexicans immigrants and also actually Mexican American citizens out of the country, you know, blaming them for the Depression, and so Gene Woolman was the one who encouraged Ross to come out and watch these Mexican-Americans and Mexican immigrants being loaded up on these trains at the depot and sent out crying as they're being sometimes being separated from their kids. He was also the person, Woolman was, who in 1936 there's this massive citrus strike and in Orange County. And the sheriff there had orders to shoot folks on sight. It was brutal. You know, Orange County was and is not the most labor-friendly place in many ways. And so Ross and Woolman went out to cross into the Orange County line to go sort of see what was happening. And when they were got to the boundary, they were pulled over by USC football players who had been kind of deputized, and they had baseball bats. And they wanted to make sure, they demanded they get out of the car, and they wanted to check the trunk to make sure that these folks, Ross and Woolman, weren't bringing food to help the striking workers. And when Ross finally arrives there, he sees these the largely Mexican-American strikers corralled in these open kind of pits, beaten, trying to talk to their wives or kids, trying to assure them that it's okay, that they're okay. And Ross writes that that was his introduction to what a strike was. So it was partly the courses, but I think it was also partly that the things that they were studying were jumping off points to go out and witness them. And that was, you know, that was really, for someone who had spent, I hope you see this photo of him, but who had spent months and months and months getting tanned and lifting weights and this, and who had led a sheltered existence, this was exciting, you know, to see all this stuff happening that I didn't even know about. And that seemed clearly, even though he wasn't really politically formed at the time, that just seemed atrocious, you know.
About the history of the expulsion of the Mexican and Mexican Americans? I mean, what, how many were involved? What were the numbers? Is it anything like what Donald Trump is proposing?
There are scholars that have had working on big books about, they called it repatriation. Hundreds of thousands, maybe millions, all over the Southwest. Texas, California, and in that swoop was many, many, many citizens that got caught up, and so it was a huge deal. And I think it was also part and parcel of this idea that California was under attack with the Depression, and so they also. The LA Police Department created what was called a bum blockade, and they sent out LA police around common crossing points in California. And anyone that showed up that didn't have proof of employment would be sent away. It was totally illegal, you know. But I think it was part of the sort of this who is at blame for the Depression, you know. It's got to be immigrants. It's got to be poor people come from other places. But I think there are good books. I don't have them on the top of my hand, but it was a major campaign. And only now I think scholars are really trying to piece together how big it was, how systematic it was. This other project in the 50s called Operation Wetback was similar as well. It was trying to, you know... the history is not new. You need work, bring in the braceros, you know. You don't need to work anymore or things around town, send them right back out. And I think it was part of that, but.
Is there any detail about how many come back? I mean, I would assume that those that got pushed on the 30s, that they would come back, especially the American citizens must have gotten back in eventually.
I think a lot of them did. Yeah, well, the citizens certainly did. And then I think a number of people might, I don't want to say more than I know, which I have a tendency of doing sometimes, which is never, Ross has one of his aphorisms is, if you don't know the answer, don't pretend you do. But I think a number of them did come back, and then eventually probably got amnesty through different periods or different. But a lot of them stayed too, and there are U.S. citizens who actually just stayed in Mexico that for one reason or another, you know, birth certificates are easy to lose. And but it is an example of how you have a sort of a hysteria, and this sort of hysteria, the target can expand very quickly and it can be messy, and you can paint very broad brushes of folks who are causing problems. You
know. What about Mexico? Did Mexico ever expel people? I mean, did they expel white people or just anybody? Or has Mexico always just accepted that their citizens leave and then come back and get kicked back in, come out? How did Mexico react to it?
To that process?
Yeah, to the whole process. I mean, do they try to keep, you know, American citizens out and say you can't come here because you're an American citizen, you belong there, or they just never pay?
I don't think so. I mean, I think in that period, Mexico called almost zero shots, mm-hmm. you know. And then once the Bracero program started, then they were kind of willing. When World War II started and there was a new labor shortage, so you send all these people out in the Depression, and then suddenly all those Jodes, all those Okies that have been working in the fields now can get jobs working in war-related industries. And so now you have a labor shortage in the fields. You also have all these Japanese-Americans who are really good growers, I mean, just incredibly skilled farmers who are now being sent out of the Pacific states. And so you have this huge problem where who's going to be managing these crops. And so that's when the Bracero program really comes in and is considered the solution. And that runs until 64. And that was a huge criticism of Chavez, that as long as you have Braceros who are working for less wages and who can be abused, it's going to be very hard to organize farm workers. And so, I mean, it's not totally a coincidence that in 64 the Bracero program ends and in 65 the first strike of the UFW is launched. You know, I think... Did you have a...
It was obvious. I was thinking about Trump as well. And I imagine there's a lot of Mexican men, well, a lot of Latinos in general, you know, who are Latinas too, of course, who are getting registered to vote.
Yeah, so I have this piece... hopefully coming out in the LA Times on Friday, looking at this question, because at the heart of Ross's work, one of them was, how do you register Latinos to vote? Because the prevailing kind of conventional wisdom back then was like, oh, they're not interested. And so when he first was working in East LA, he wanted to have one of the folks from the election committee come out and have 50 people that the CSO had recruited who wanted to become deputy registrars and go door-to-door to vote. And the guy was like, well, I would do that, but the only problem is Mexicans aren't interested in that, so it'll be a waste of my time. And they leaned on him, and he finally came out, and 47 folks became the deputy registrars. And in 2 years, they changed the landscape of East LA. In 1947, Edward Roy Ball, who had been the candidate, gets like 2,000 votes or something. In 1949, he gets 25,000 votes, highest precinct ever. It's a total wake-up call for the LA power structure. And I think that remains one interesting lesson I think you can look at from Ross is that there are a lot... There's a lot that's changed. I don't know what Ross would think about Twitter and Facebook and stuff, but at the end of the day, there is this ancient power of face-to-face communication, and that it wasn't Ross did not find paid canvassers who would go out and go door-to-door. They had volunteers who would go out and actually take responsibility. They had contests, like how many people can you register? And one guy registered over 2,000 people. another three women registered more than 500 people, and they created like a kind of standings in the paper, like a sports women's division, men's divisions, who's doing more, and really getting people involved in that kind of work. And I think one of the things I'm arguing in this piece about why voter registration among Latinos has been at about 58% from 1992 on, despite many, many different efforts, including mobile apps that you can now register on your smartphone. And one of the arguments I'm making is that we should look at why 1947 and 49 worked so well in East LA, and it wasn't because people were going door-to-door just asking people to vote. It's because people were going door-to-door saying, this is not going to work without you taking charge of your block and coming out and door-knocking with us and kind of a community effort. And I think that's, Trump provides an impetus to, I'm amazed when you listen to Spanish radio. Every story at some point is about how insane this guy is. I was just like, last week and a half, I was doing a piece about Trump's immigrant workforce that works in his golf course in L.A. And there are 23 workers that manage the golf course that cut the lawns and stuff, and 22 of them are either from Mexico or El Salvador. In the restaurant, almost all of them are of Mexican descent. Many are now, quote-unquote, legal residents because they got amnesty 386, but, Trump is so hardcore against amnesty, and yet he's also, his whole workforce couldn't be there without the amnesty from 1986. So I think, and I would ask them, is there anyone broadly speaking, not just at the workforce, but maybe some crazy neighbor upstairs who kind of thinks that Trump is on to something, and no one ever said anything to me. So I think there's, because it's maybe Spanish media and it's harder to report sometimes in English papers that not so in tune with it, but it's overwhelming how much animosity there is towards Trump.
You have to understand, Donald Trump is not a stupid man. And he's getting more press than any other candidate probably has ever gotten and not spent any money.
Mm-hmm.
So he can inflame for another month or two. Then he can do a turnaround, because this country won't run without Mexican labor. And we all know that.
His companies won't.
No, the country won't run. The Mexicans in America do the labor. Americans don't work anymore. They're busy on their phones. Well, they're just, Americans don't work. I have a whole description of what the average American is today. And if it weren't for the Mexicans and their value of the family, my other comment would be, I don't think it's in the Mexican nature to be like an American. So they don't rally and vote and do all that. I was one time in Mexico City at a time when there was a big gathering of people from all over the country to come to this major church. They came on their hands and knees that were bleeding. And I was with my lady friend. I said, this is faith. I have never seen faith. That was my first exposure to what it means to have faith. Those people live on faith. They don't live like the average American citizen. If you don't like this, then you hire somebody, you sue somebody, and you do all those funny things that we do with attorneys, instead of living a life dedicated to a higher power. That's, I think, the basic, and that's why they're easily led and duped into doing things against their benefit.
Well, I don't know if you remember from 2006, those were some of the most massive public demonstrations in the history of this country. Of Mexican immigrants and ethnic Mexicans and sort of white allies around. James Sensenbrenner had produced this, proposed a law that was very nasty. L.A., I think, had more than a half million people on the streets. Houston had maybe 750,000 people on the streets. New York City had, when I was there, I was running them, had 500,000. Chicago was huge. And so I would say that they come, you can't ever generalize, but too much. that there is a deep history of mobilizing. I was in a very small town in Alabama for a couple months when I was working at this chicken plant for this same book I was working on. And it was mostly white, very conservative little rural Alabama town. But they had a chicken plant which had attracted a lot of Mexican and Guatemalan workers. And when these marches started showing up around the country in these huge cities, they held their own march. And in one day, and the white politicians were like, no, we don't do this kind of stuff. We don't do marches. And they said, but we do. And with 24 hours notice, they turned out like 750 people to march down this town that was like, I don't know, a couple thousand people. And so I think you could say they were duped if you think that they're rallying behind Trump, or they don't understand that they think that Trump has some sort of interest in them, or that they're less likely to engage politically. But if you look at some of the most militant, active labor unions in this country right now, I mean, it's very rare that you will not see immigrant workers sort of helping drive that. And the sacrifice piece, I mean, Caesar was huge on sacrifice. Penitentiary and these fasts that one of them almost practically killed him. But I think that sacrifice also goes into a commitment to often making things better. So it's not just a sacrifice sometimes it is a sacrifice for sacrifice's sake, but it's a sacrifice to highlight the extent to which people feel so strongly about an issue that they're willing to do this to make sure that someone pays attention, you know.
We have time for one more question. Anybody like to ask it?
I was just going to ask, you had said that his parents were spectacularly wrong about kind of his beliefs when it came to other races and people. And I got, when you described what he got, I got a sense for what he was excited and motivated by actual organizing. But what do you think it was that motivated him to want to better things for other races and people that his parents had said he would not want to based on their beliefs?
You know, I think he really enjoyed, I think he had a vision. I think he was fundamentally anti-racist in a way that's hard to figure out exactly how he was like that, because it didn't come from his family. But I've interviewed many, many people. I think one of the ways that you see his anti-racism actually most come to light is that when he's working with both Black, Mexican-American, Native Americans, what they all told me from the very beginning is that he held the same high standards for them that he held for everyone else. And one guy was telling me this time in Syracuse where there was this one really, really, really charismatic Black organizer that he was working with in Syracuse, but he didn't follow through on things a lot. He enjoyed giving speeches. And, you know, Ross is this white guy. They're organizing mostly Black folks there. And for Ross to sit down and say, I think you're doing this really wrong, and I think spoke in some ways to that anti-racism, which was he held everyone. Caesar talked about this. He was a slave driver, but he didn't pity you. He wasn't paternalistic. He didn't play favorites. And I think people really respected that they saw that he did that. How did he come about that exactly? It helps that he was so curious. Like, I think he was so curious about people that if you're curious about people, you talk to them about things a lot. You talk to them about things a lot, and you start realizing that a lot of the stuff that they've dealing with, you can relate to in some way. And I think that also went a long ways, that poor people, Black people, Latinos, Native Americans were not an abstraction. They were not someone who had just been pushed down that needed his help. They needed a white savior to come in. They needed to sort of learn some, they needed some guidance maybe in learning some tools, but at the end of the day, he had no doubt that they had the ability to fix things on their own. And that, and again, you try to figure out why, how'd that come about? And it's a little bit mysterious to me about why he was so much that way, but I never met anyone who, there was this a UFW organizer who died recently, a couple years ago. He was one of the few black leaders of the executive board of the UFW. And when he talked about Ross at kind of a memorial, he said that Ross would go from, in a meeting, he'd go from person to person and ask how the organizing went that day. So who'd you talk to? I talked to these people. Well, how'd it go? Good. Well, what do you mean good? Well, I mean that I talked to this lady. What'd you say to her? I said this. What'd she say back? Well, she said she's not really. Well, what did you say to that? I mean, it was just like people remember this from decades ago that he would not just let you slide. And there was this video of this guy named Mac, who is a leader, who was in this circle with him for the first time. And he said, so Mac, who did you talk to? And Mac says, da-da-da, you know. And Ross grills him the same way. And Mac says, at that point, you did not talk to a black person that way. And that in that environment, that it could have been seen, but that really led him to respect Ross in a very deep way, that he, again, for whatever reason, he had that ability. So, but it is, I have to say, you know, you write a book, you spend so much time and you can't quite figure out how the hell it happened. Except that it seemed like it was there.
You mentioned about Wolmuck, the student, that he was a communist.
Woolman. Yeah.
Was a communist. Was Fred Ross at all, was he a communist? And if he was at any point along the way, did it get in his way later on?
I don't think he was a communist, but his at different points when he's organizing in the Citrus Belt in east of L.A., they're able to throw out a city council person who's racist and also is a big member of the growers. And so the grower organization starts tracking him. They start calling him Red Ross. The FBI gets involved. There's a big file of Ross's activities with the FBI. And it gets in the way of his organizing. A lot of people abandoned him because even the priest, one of his leaders, a priest comes and talked to his leaders and said, you know, Ross is involved in all this subversive stuff. We think he's a communist. Ross had a huge respect for the role that communists played in social struggles during the Depression. Ross had zero interest in communist orthodoxy or in he really wanted to build organizations that were loyal to the work. He did not want to have people who had some other hidden agenda who wanted to lob onto the CSO as a way to start bringing up all these other issues. And so I think to the extent that he really was not that ideological, you know, he was kind of like he was simple in some ways. His simple thought was that you bring people together and that's the only way that are sort of being affected by issues that can make things happen. But he is not the kind of guy that would have long debates about, you know, do we need to seize the means of production?
Yeah.
I would suggest something to you about him. That was his source of power. See, all of us have a source of power. Something drives all of us to stay alive. And that was that's what his source of power was, that he could organize people and he could take, they were easier to organize than if you move up the ladder and go to college and try to organize educated people. If you organize these people, that gives you a sense of power that, and the more you did it, the more it drove you. That's what, the way I see him, as that's his source of sustainability for himself.
Great, thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you, Gabriel, for a great talk on somebody that we didn't know enough about. And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 114th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much.